Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Today with Mark Satin. Mark is the author of the book The Radical Middle, and a long-time policy analyst and thinker, futurist thinker, and creative policy thinker. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
I, as we've said before, off-air, I have followed your career for many years. Used to subscribe to your newsletter, the New Age Politics newsletter.
Yes.
And delighted to reconnect. But it has been quite a journey for you. And let's start there, because you have a chapter in this book, Journey to the Radical Middle. And you started way back as a draft dodger and activist in the anti-Vietnam War movement and in the New Left. And where did it go from there?
Well, I actually, if you want to call me a draft dodger, that's fine. But the
isn't that the name? I wouldn't call you a draft dodger, a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War. But
yeah,
didn't you write a book called Confessions of a Draft Dodger?
Yeah, Confessions of a Young Exile, exactly. I was the person up in Toronto who helped to found and was first executive director of the Toronto Anti-Draft Program, which actually helped to bring guys up. We were the major draft resistance counseling center up in Toronto for many years. And I wrote the manual for draft age immigrants. This is of course several lifetimes ago. I'm sorry I even mentioned it here, except to say that I went up there because I felt I would be more effective working against the war from Canada than I would from jail in the United States. And I certainly didn't want to do some Clinton-esque thing and pretend to be in school when I was really just avoiding the draft. It just wasn't my way of operating in the world, for better or worse. Sometimes I ask myself if I cared more about what Clinton called the viability of his career, what would have happened to me. But perhaps I'd have had a very different life course. But I've been an activist ever since and have no regrets. And to answer your question, I was involved in the left long enough and hard enough that at some point, I became disillusioned with the anger and the violence. I was peripherally involved with the Weathermen. It just didn't seem to me to be going anywhere, and it seemed to me to be doing more harm than good. So I got involved in New Age points of view, not so much spiritual as trying to translate that into political, humanistic ways of working. I wrote a book called New Age Politics and helped to start a group called the New World Alliance that tried to make New Age ideas, the humanistic ideas, ideas that have to do with people's psychology being very important. I tried to make those ideas more politically salient. And after a while, and I wrote a newsletter, that the one you subscribed to, it was called New Options, for 10 years. It seemed to me, after doing that for all that time, that I was really preaching to the converted, and that, you know, 25-year-olds were in a completely different mental set than the old guys that I was writing for and about. And I decided, perhaps precipitously, but I wanted so strongly to do this, I decided to join the mainstream and become a lawyer. And I did. I went to New York University Law School, a wonderful, wonderful place. I enjoyed it as only mid-career law students can. There was no pressure. It was an intellectual feast, and there's no other way to put it. I know those are Bork's words, but he was right. It was very exciting, but legal practice left me cold. I was not able to bring my ideas or my personality or anything unique to Mark Satin into the work. I mean, you're just laws, really, unless you're very lucky, laws simply for bright people to do what they're supposed to do and then go home late at night, and you keep that up for 20 or 30 years and you become very rich, and that appeals to some people, but it didn't really appeal to me as a lifestyle, and I felt I had more to offer, so I started the newsletter Radical Middle. And then I wrote the book Radical Middle, which just came out last month. And there, I try to pull everything together. I try to take the political passion that I learned from the left. I try to take the insistence on reconciliation and healing that I took from the New Age. But I also took from the establishment law experiences I had a real conviction that without credibility and expertise, you're not going to be able to do very much in this society. And my book and my newsletter try to present the politics that takes all those experiences and insights into account. So it keeps me busy.
Well, it's been very interesting, and I think that the ideas that you present in the book are fascinating. My principal concern about it, as still a committed leftist of some variety,
yeah,
although I have about a dozen different modifiers that I put on my ideas, you know, libertarian or whatever, but my principal concern is whether there's some kind of ideological core there, you know. So, and I know that you're really grappling with that yourself. You're trying to find what the key ideas might be,
mm-hmm.
And also whether it's really new, because there's certainly a history of people who have tried to triangulate existing political dichotomies and say that there are some, you know, like FM 2030 had his book Upwingers back in 1972. And the Greens, you know, said we're neither left nor right but forward.
So, oh yeah, I had lots of experience with them.
And right, and Ross Perot and John
mm-hmm.
McCain, and so, you know, is this in a tradition of some of these other efforts at triangulation, or are you really trying to get at some new set of philosophical ideas?
The latter. I you'll be pleased to know. No, I'm not. I'm not trying to be one of those people that makes mushy compromises between the left and right, and kind of sets up straw people on the left and right, and says, "Hey, I'm, you know, different." I think that's not only unethical, but it's very unappealing. It just doesn't work. I mean, you can see that there aren't many people following any of the people you named apart from McCain today. What I try to do is actually listen to what the deepest concerns are on the left and what the deepest concerns are on the right, and synthesize them in new policies and programs that go beyond what the left and right are speaking to now. I don't care whether it, with regard to some policies, I end up sounding more left, and in other areas I end up sounding more right. It isn't a matter at all of just, you know, splitting the difference. What I do insist on, though, is that usually, I would actually argue always, what the left is saying and what the right is saying has a core of truth. And if you don't pay attention to that truth, you're going to come up with public policies that aren't as interesting or viable or useful for people as if you will accept that the left and the right are both saying things that matter and you need to take their deepest concerns into account. I'm not saying that with regard to gay marriage, for instance, you need to accept the far right's insistence that it should only be between a man and a woman. And I'm not saying you should do what many on the left would do and have just, you know, anything goes. What I am saying, though, is that you need to listen to the pain of gay people when they claim that their love relationship is not being recognized by the society. And you should also listen to the pain that traditionalists express when they say that their concern for the next generation, which they express through children, must be given a higher degree of recognition than two people who simply want to cohabit. And just to use that as an example, a radical middle solution to this dilemma would be listen to both sides and come up with perhaps a new interpretation of marriage for the 21st century. I'm deliberately choosing a provocative example for your listeners. Most of those I use in the book would be more palatable, but I think to a majority of people. But this one is good because it gets at what I'm trying to do. A radical middle approach to marriage might say that if you wish to live together and commit yourselves to each other, you can form a civil union, and it doesn't matter the sex or the sexual orientation or the age or whatever of the people involved.
Or the number.
Or the number.
Yeah, good.
But
I'm there with you.
It's nobody's business. I mean, it's truly nobody's business. And frankly, so many people in the legal profession, this shocked me even in my 40s in New York, so many males in the legal profession have both a wife and a mistress. I mean, you basically have lots and lots of essentially couples that are simply unrecognized, and the degree of secretiveness and legal trauma that involves is just sad to see. But
Marx in the Communist Manifesto says that it's bizarre that the bourgeois accuse communists of wanting to have common property in women when it's precisely the bourgeois who have common property in women.
That's right. They can afford. It is funny. But we would go beyond this at the radical middle, and perhaps you can go this far with me, Jay. Once a couple wishes to conceive and does conceive, or once it wishes to adopt, or once something is started in a petri dish, once a child is on the horizon, that union can then become a marriage, and that marriage, unlike the civil union, the marriage would get the economic benefits that marriage gets today, because though it's none of society's business whether you're sleeping with someone or, you know, whether they live at home with you or whether they live down the street, it is definitely society's business what happens to the children that you're bringing up in the world. So in that case, I think it's right for society to step in and say, these are the regulations and these are the economic benefits you'll get by raising children for the entire society.
I'm almost there with you. The idea that I've been advocating is modular cohabitation and child rearing contracts that are open to both sexes and to at least small numbers of people. Mm-hmm. And I think that basically we need to get the religious ideas out of the contracts that the state recognizes to protect children and to protect people's interdependence with each other. And I think you're absolutely right that the protection of the interests of children is a higher priority than many of the other protections. But I think the protection of common property, for instance, in a situation of simple cohabitation is at least as important to some as the common property in children.
Right. That you could certainly make that argument. I would say that what I try to do in all of the different issue areas that I deal with in the book, we're getting back to your initial question as to whether this is in fact a new analysis with a new point of view or whether it's just mushy compromise. I do come up with four key values which I feel that all of the radical middle issues share.
By the way, I like those key values a lot, but why don't you lay them out for us?
Yeah, sure. The first is, how can we give ourselves more choices in life? The second is, how can we give ourselves a fair start in life? The third is, how can we maximize our potential as human beings as much as possible? And the fourth is, how can we be of genuine use to the developing world? And though this doesn't have the analytic elegance of Marx and Lenin and those wonderful folks on the right, it is a quick and ready guide to humane public policies. And I think if people on the radical middle make sure that whatever they advocate fits comfortably with at least one of these values, we will, and I do in the book, I think I can say that comfortably, we will come up with policies and that do fit into a larger humane whole, and it would be much more relevant for the 21st century than anything coming out of liberalism or conservatism today.
Well, let's start with maximizing choice for everyone, because the evolution that I've made, I mean, I was never an authoritarian leftist, I've got my teeth cut by getting active with the yippies in high school and then became a social democrat, and now I'm some kind of libertarian leftist.
Oh, this is fun that we're doing a journey together. I didn't realize that about you.
Right. And
all these twists and turns.
Exactly. But the consequence is that maximizing choice for everyone has become a central concern for me. And I'm very sympathetic, for instance, with Amartya Sen's argument that that libertarians and socialists start from the same point of view. It's just the question of what do you do with the fact that society is radically unequal, and that some people, to have real choice, need some kind of subsidies or some kind of help in order to have real choices in life. And
exactly.
So, you know, the obvious converse is that you don't want to have like a national health system that only gives everybody one choice. You want to have as many choices as possible within public provision, and then maintain some kind of market society on the side so that people can have choices through markets as well.
Sure, you need a basic health care for all, and then people can buy alternatives. Though I do think the basic health care system should build in many preventive and alternative options, which would of course provide even the poorest people with choice, healthy choices in how they wish to take care of themselves. And I would also agree with you that it's incumbent on the government to spend much more money on public health care, which of course, as you would well know, Jay, every dollar spent on public health will save us money in the long run.
Well, that sounds like something that all the public health folks get behind. It's, you know, whenever you look at these studies that, you know, every dollar spent on prenatal care saves us $4 in neonatal intensive care and so on and so forth. We just have a system that makes bucks off of doing intensive medicine and doesn't make bucks yet off of keeping people healthy.
One of the points I try to make, and I make again and again, is that both political parties now are not speaking to the needs of the nation as a whole. Both of them have their favorite constituencies to whom they pander shamelessly. And it's a tragedy because there needs to be at least one political party that will act on behalf of the good of the whole. And there is no party that is now advocating the sort of expenditures on public health that I do in my book and that, as you say, many public health groups are advocating, even though it can be shown and has been shown by numerous credible studies that this will save us all money. It's the saddest thing in the world where intelligent, insightful people can make their case again and again and again, and yet the political parties are not equipped to do anything with that material.
Well, let me take issue with that, because Bill Clinton, who was also a triangulator, who tried to...
I wouldn't use the word also. He was a triangulator.
He was a triangulator.
He gave what I'm trying to do a bad name.
Right. He was a triangulator. But in the case of his health care reform plan, which was actually Hillary's and a bunch of other people's health care reform plan, it had the key feature of it was that it would have given every American an equally funded voucher that they could have then had a choice of different health plans to buy from. And so it seems like it would have been the natural policy reflecting the principles that you've described.
It went part of the way there, but it wouldn't have built in preventive or alternative care nearly as much as I'd have wanted to. And I think even more egregiously, it still connected the health care system to the workplace. I think in the 21st century, where people change jobs often, not just poor people, but everyone is changing jobs now frequently, and will be doing so even more as the century goes along. It's high time to separate healthcare from employment, so people don't have to worry that if they want to change jobs, they'll be putting their health plan at risk.
I'm speaking with Mark Satin. He's the author of the book Radical Middle, and you can find his work and his extensive web of contacts and ideas at radicalmiddle.com. And he's a very engaging policy theorist and thinker. Now, helping the developing world, I mean, as with all of these ideas that you lay out, and especially these core principles, a lot depends on where you go with it. And so, on the one hand, there's the free trade advocates who argue that the way to help the developing world is to have as much free trade as possible. On the other hand, there's the fair trade folks who argue that we need global regulation of trade and global development plans and so on. Mm-hmm. I presume that you're coming out a little bit towards the fair trade end of this.
Well, not really. I think if you had to put me on a spectrum, I'd come out more on the free trade side, because once again, if you look at what helps the country as a whole in the long run, I think that would be free trade, but I do come out on the fair trade side in this one area. It's astonishing to me and really shameful that the individuals in this country who are hurt by free trade aren't helped to find jobs. I mean, this is just a tragedy. They should be helped in many ways, and not only should the government exercise much more care and energy in finding people comparable jobs, but it should engage in job retraining and high quality job retraining. It should help to move people to places where better jobs are if they wish to move. It should allow people who are hurt by free trade to engage in further education if that education would arguably help them find better work, and in many other ways they should be helped to move on. I do think it's exciting to have one world, which is functioning as one integrated world. I think, and if we're going to have world peace, we really need to cooperate with each other, and countries really do have advantages. Obviously, countries that are just starting out, building up an industrial base, will have a workforce that's less expensive, and it makes sense for the long-run interests of everyone for countries to be able to pursue their natural advantages. But if we don't help, I mean seriously help, the people who are hurt through this energetic maelstrom, we're doing a great disservice. And
you actually argue in the book for guaranteed employment and a form of basic income, though.
Yes, I do. Yeah, well, so. The basic income, not really. I do argue for guaranteed employment. Anyone who wants work, I would say should be able to get a job either through the government or my preference, as I state in the book. I would like the government to subsidize private industry in clever ways that would permit private employers to hire more people. I just think people who are employed in private industry, even with government funds are involved, will have a much higher sense of self-esteem.
So the Humphrey Hawkins full employment bill, is that something?
Nah.
No.
No, but if the government subsidizes private industry so that it makes it easy for them to hire marginal workers at lower costs, and especially, of course, if the companies don't have to provide health insurance for all their workers, because this would be done through the private insurance system, with the government subsidizing people who can't afford private insurance, we would then have a system that would work best for everyone, I think. And yes, everyone would have a job.
You're not a basic income advocate in the traditional sense, but you're more like Michael Lynn's give everybody a nest egg that they can take with them kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of people are arguing for the nest egg now, and it's a wonderful argument. You sink $6,000 into everyone's account at birth, and you don't allow them to touch that money till they reach 18, and lo and behold, it will reach at least $20,000, and probably more, by the time you're ready to go to college. And that means that every person, no matter how poor, every little kid growing up will know that they'll have a stake in society if they spend that money intelligently, either on tuition or on starting a private business or on a first home. If they spend that money wisely, they'll be able to make it in life. And lots of people don't think that now. And if you don't think you're going to make it in life, why should you study in school? I mean, why would you bother? It takes a very rare person to think that they have no life chances, but that they should still think about Shakespeare. I mean, you know, it just you just can't expect everyone to do that. But if everyone knows that they'll have $20,000 or $30,000 when they're ready to go to college, it will fasten the mind on the future.
One of the groups that you link to from your site as an example of radical middle policies, and you link to a number of different groups which have very distinct political complexions, but one of the groups is the Communitarian Network. And it seems like your policy proposal of universal service, not necessarily military service, but universal service of some kind, comes out of that communitarian idea.
It is communitarian in a sense, because it puts the community first. But I mean, you can get that from the left and the right too. The left definitely says that to the extent that we need to be defended, it needs to be done by everyone, not just the poor. And of course, it also says that there are lots and lots of jobs that are not getting done today that need to get done. Jobs are everything from homeland security to nurturing old people who are ill and alone. And the right also says that you cannot run a complex, large, rich society in a world without providing for its defense, and that it's everyone's duty to aid our defense. So all three of those provide background for my advocacy of the draft. And I have to say, in this instance, my own experience being a draft dodger, as you put it, does contribute to this, because in 1967, when I went to Canada, I would have been happy to serve this country. In fact, I was in Mississippi doing civil rights work immediately before coming up to Canada, and I saw that as national service, but of course the government did not. But I would have loved to have a choice of choosing between community service, homeland security, and military service. And if I'd had that choice, I'd have chosen community service at the drop of a hat. But I would also have been willing to accept that for the year that I was doing community service, I would simply get a stipend that would pay my food and rent. I wouldn't want to make any money to speak of. And if I were doing homeland security, which might involve 2 years of patrolling the border, riding on planes or whatever, I would be happy to accept a normal salary. But if I were to choose going into the military for 3 years, I would want, and I do advocate in my book, that those people should be able to get a traditional World War II GI type bill when they get out. So the deal is this: if you want to join the Knowledge Society, if you want to be part of the evolving 21st century, and you're poor and you go into the military, you will come out with the ability to get whatever education you're capable of getting and joining the society in a very significant way.
Well, Mark, we have to call it to a close, but you have about another dozen ideas that
just gotten started.
I know.
And I feel badly. I mean, I was so interested in the dialogue we were going to have, but I'm afraid I did most of the talking.
Oh, no, it's fine, because I'm going to have you back and do my best to transhumanize and re-radicalize your idea base, because I think...
Good luck.
I know. Given your track record of thinking about these things, I may not have much success, but
I'm constantly looking. Learning, Jay. Don't worry.
At least we'll have a good conversation the next time around as well.
Great.
Well, you can find out more about Mark Satin at radicalmiddle.com, and his book is available through all the usual sources. I'm not allowed to mention them anymore because we're non-commercial radio, but just go online. You can find the Radical Middle just about everywhere. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Thanks a lot, Jay. It was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.